Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is January 21st, 2026, and this is episode 575. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, in Western New York State, cold as hell, Western New York State. You're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe, please, and support the show. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. And I'm in line, of course, with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in Southern Italy. How you doing, John?
Cold. Yeah. I mean,
you that's, too.
Yeah. I expect, you know, your part of the world to be cold, but not ours. And it's a scam, too, because we looked up the temperature for Gallipoli and they say, oh, it's 12 degrees. Yeah. And then we looked up the BBC and it said, yeah, it's 5 degrees there.
Yeah. There's that feels so, like factor too.
Yeah.
And you guys have the sea sort of, so your cold probably gets sort of a rawer cold. Like,
yeah, a nice little sea breeze that's not so nice.
I mean, it's nice in the summertime when it's hot, but yeah,
not
in the dead of winter. Okay, we're going to have a great interview. And for this, we want to really thank a friend of the show, Cyrus, for lining it up. We were able to get through to a researcher, an academic, an Iranian American who is in Tehran. Now, of course, there's an internet blackout in Tehran, so we couldn't use any of sort of the normal means of reaching him. So we had to use phone and Zoom. And I know that our perfectionist sound engineer, Brendan, it makes him squirm. But because the sound is just not that great, but I think everybody understands, you know, the circumstances here. So the sound's going to be a little different. You're going to hear us switching over to Zoom to speak with our guest. Real quickly, John, before we get to it, I mean, all of this is kind of tied in one way or another because, you know, there's this big Davos meeting of all the globalists. And this one's a little bit different because you have a whole bunch of these European leaders meeting there under threat from Trump to invade Denmark or Denmark's territory, Greenland. And, you know, they don't know how to stand up or how to deal with it. And Trump is also, there was just a nice well-massaged story planted in Murdoch's Wall Street Journal just a few hours ago about how Trump is also looking for a, quote, decisive blow against Iran. And when we talk to Navid, our guest, we're going to see how delusional as well as sociopathic and maniacal such talk is. But one person sort of stood out here, and I don't know if you saw.
I know.
Mark.
The Canadian of all people.
Mark Carney, as friend of the show Dan Beckner calls him, Mark Carney, who was I think it might be because, now we're not saying that he's a good guy or he's suddenly become, you know, he's like the new Trotsky or Lenin or something. What he did do was, did the really unusual thing, especially for a centrist, which is to tell things how they are. And because what we've seen from all the other NATO aid Western leaders is a steadfast refusal to accept the horrible reality, horrible for them. They're terrified of losing their American cover for a variety of reasons, one of which is that's where their own power comes from. Right. So here's what Mark Carney said yesterday. He said, I'll just quote a little bit of it. He said, we knew that the story about the rules-based order was partially false. We knew that international law applied with varying rigor, depending on the identity of the accused and the victim. This fiction was useful, so we placed the sign in the window. We participated in the rituals, and we largely avoided calling out the gaps between rhetoric and reality. This bargain no longer works. Let me be direct. We are in the midst of a rupture, not a transition. You cannot live within the lie of mutual benefit through integration when integration becomes the source of your subordination. It's pretty remarkable, I have to say.
Yep. And to all those, including myself, who said Canadians are allergic to direct talk, I am properly chastised.
Yeah. He just got back from going to China, setting up a deal that really upset Trump. But, you know, he's trying to create some sovereign space for Canada by setting up separate trade deals with dreaded China, which, you know, Canada has been like a loyal lapdog to the U.S., arresting, you know, Huawei executives for us and so on. But I guess no more. Yeah. And Dan Bakner's theory was that when he went out and met Xi, Dan posted a photo from the movie version of Manchurian Candidate, as if President Xi hypnotized an MK Ultra at Mark Carney and unleashed him on the West. But anyway, let's get straight to our interview with our guest in Tehran, Navid Zarina. Okay, so we are very excited, honored to have with us today a guest coming from inside Tehran in Iran to talk about the latest protest, riots, and what is happening from his point of view from on the ground. His name is Navid Zarinal. He's an Iranian-American academic. He also has a Patreon, the Colony Archive. And I just want to add as well that he was recommended to us by one of our show favorites, Cyrus. So we're very excited to have Navid on, and he was being very helpful to connect. And so, Navid, first of all, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on. And welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on Radio Warner.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So the first thing I want to ask you, Navid, is before we get into the circumstances of the protests, are you in any particular danger? Like, I don't want to get anybody in trouble. I listened to the Drop Site News interview with a protester. You know, they covered up her identity. They changed her voice. And so on, and she seemed to be very pro-protester, and we could talk about this whole phenomenon too. But are you in danger here? I'm sorry, there in Tehran right now for talking to us, or in danger in general?
I can't say that I am because I didn't participate in the protests. More a spectator, and also. I live in Iran, and honestly, I mean, even during the protests, I didn't see too many of them. So, I mean, I think there's this perception outside Iran that the protests are comparable to the 1979 revolution, because in the 1979 revolution, by some estimates, about 10% of the population was actively participating in the protests. And I think when you look at the numbers, even the French and the Russian revolutions that were some of the biggest revolutions of modern history only had about 2 or 3% of the population participating. Mm-hmm. So 10% is a massive number. But compared to the 1979 revolution, I think the numbers were much smaller. So it wasn't if you were just going about your day shopping or seeing friends or seeing family, you wouldn't necessarily run into protest, or you would have run into the security forces. I've been kind of living my life, just the ebbs and flows, the daily kind of routines and the daily hustle. So I'm safe. Thank you for asking. And I mean, regarding the number of the protesters, I was seeing one report by the Iranian media that about 350,000 to 400,000 Iranians participated in the protests, and even if we are more generous and say 500,000 people participated, that's still about 0.5% of the population. January 8th and January 9th got very violent, but again, I was not subject to any of the violence, and currently I'm safe.
Right. You've been in Iran, as I understand it, from talking with Cyrus before he introduced me to you. But you've been in previous protests, or you have at least, you know, witnessed them. How would you compare whatever you've seen with what's going on now to any of the previous? I mean, there have been just a series of protests, certainly since the so-called Green Revolution protests in 2009-10. I don't know which other ones you saw, but could you compare them?
So I haven't, and just to correct the premise of the question, I was not a participant in any of the protests as such.
Okay.
I was not an organizer or a participant. But if you want to compare it to the Green Movement of 2009, and I want to call it a revolution, that was kind of a misnomer.
Yes.
That was used in the Western media. So it wasn't a revolution in any theoretical meaning of the term. Rather, it was a movement. Hamid Abashi, who is a professor at Columbia, called it civil rights movement, and I think you could perhaps call it the civil rights movement, but it was more so, to give you the context for the Green Movement. The Green Movement happened due to a disputed presidential election. So it was Ahmadinejad going for his second term against Mir Hossein Mousavi, and Mir Hossein Mousavi was the reformist candidate. Mm-hmm. And then he claimed, and the supporters claimed, that Ahmadinejad had rigged the election in Ahmadinejad's favor, even though there's no conclusive evidence that there was rigging or cheating in the elections. And Ahmadinejad was actually very popular at the time, so it was very reasonable for him to win most of the votes. I'm not ruling out that there might have been some irregularities in the election, but there was no real conclusive evidence. And even when you travel throughout Iran to this day, Ahmadinejad is very popular because he had a large social base, and then especially in the villages and the smaller towns, he supported infrastructure and giving out loans and housing projects. So he is popular to this day. And so the Green Movement essentially was about the disputed election, but then it became about the wider issues of civil and political rights. And then the marches then, it was a lot less violent. So let's start with that. So the protesters were a lot less violent. There were fewer riots, much fewer damage to public properties and common properties. And the numbers were much greater. From my understanding, there were more participants. So I just gave you the data for this protest and riots that happened last week. And it was about 400,000 people participating by some estimates, but I think for the Green Movement, the numbers were larger. And the Green Movement was more of an urban movement. There were it was happening more in the cities, whereas this time you had a lot of participants. It was a kind of a more nationwide thing, and it affected also smaller towns and villages in the country.
Right. So, I want to get directly to one of the most contentious points. We talked about it a bit when we did a short episode on the protest a week ago, but I know you've also started to write this up as well, that the role of foreign intelligence in the Iranian protest, and there seem to have been sort of two phases of the protest. The first phase being, I guess, December 28th or 29th, when the first protest broke out in the bazaars and then eventually started to spread. But this was the sort of the nonviolent period. And then sometime between Pahlavi's big call to take on the government on, I think it was the 6th and around the 8th or 9th, things turned violent. And I guess I want to ask you, to what extent, to what extent are these protests organic? And I think we have to factor into this the sanctions and the snapback sanctions. I mean, Scott Bessent in Davos yesterday just bragged that the sanctions were designed to bring people out on the streets. So we can't ignore that either. But to what extent is organic, and to what extent do you see the hand of foreign intelligence agencies?
On the morning of December 29th, segments of the Tehran Bazaar, including the shopkeepers who sold electronics, started protesting, and they closed shop and they started settling in nearby streets. So initially it was very organic, and it was in response to the economic situation, specifically inflation. So inflation is very high in Iran. Annually it's about 30 to 40%. So everything from merchandise to consumer items to professional services, the haircuts, everything increases by about 40% annually, and sometimes it increases twice a year. Rent increases by a little bit less, so rent usually increases by about 25% depending on the landlord. But then the services and the consumer products increased by about 40%. And that's you know, a lot of inflation. And you can tell that by the Iranian currency because there's so many zeros. And, you know, you count everything in millions. So that, you know, similar to other sanctioned countries, there is massive hyperinflation here. But this time it was worse because if we all usually loses value annually, especially since 2017, that it's been declining. But this time it was declining far too rapidly. So it was moving from, say, 90,000 toman to a dollar, all of a sudden to about 140,000 toman to a dollar. So that's about a 50,000 toman increase. And because of that, and I even experienced it firsthand. So I went to the barber, and I remember I went once, and the next 2 weeks, so 2 weeks later, his price had increased, reacting to the Iranian currency losing its value. So because of this rapid inflation happening, you know, every month, what happened to the shopkeepers is that they're not able to sell stuff because people are not buying it, because the purchasing right. power goes down and people are not buying. And also, they're having a hard time buying stuff, the shopkeepers themselves. So inflation is a big problem, and they're all reacting to it. So in that sense, it's organic, even though in large part is caused by the imperialist policies of the U.S. sanctions, but in that sense, it's organic. And up until January 7th, the protests, where you could call them popular protests led by the people without foreign intervention, and the violence was pretty contained. So, I mean, there were instances of people causing damage to governmental buildings, but they were pretty limited, and there was probably force used by the security forces. But that was also pretty contained. From what I saw and heard, is that the police was just mostly there to for crowd control and to, you know, manage urban safety and to manage traffic and all. Similar to, I mean, say, you know, in the U.S., you might have a Black Lives Matter protest. And a lot of them were, you know, peaceful in the sense that both the protesters and the police response was peaceful, but then violence broke out at certain stages. So similar. So that, I mean, this is, I think, the point that I have to emphasize is that there is this kind of strange Orientalist representation in the Western media that Iranian politics and social movements are somehow, you know, exceptionally weird and the state is exceptionally violent. But they're pretty similar to, you know, protests that happen in Western countries, and the state response can also be similar. I mean, it's really interesting because the German chancellor, who has been in a way deferential to the Israeli genocide, and he made a statement recently that the Iranian government is in its final days, and it will collapse within days because, you know, it's only maintaining power through violence and bullets. But I think what he's missing is that the officer's idea, Louis Althusser, has this a good idea that we can apply across the world to all different states, the repressive state apparatus. And, you know, all states are inherently repressive and violent. And the same happens in Iran, is that if there are riots and if the government thinks that it's losing control, it will reassert its authority through violence and force. And so this is what happened here too on January 8th, as you mentioned. Reza Pahlavi, who is the so-called crown prince, currently in exile in the U.S., and his father, the Shah, was supported by the U.S. up until 1979, before he was deposed through the Iranian Revolution. He issued a statement that day calling for the protests to expand, and then the things got violent. And it seems that it was at that point that whoever was collaborating from the protesters with the foreign intelligence, probably U.S. and Israel, they started becoming more violent, and they started trying to destroy infrastructure and destroy important governmental buildings, and also setting fire to social service infrastructure. And at that point, things got violent, and the organic protest turned into a regime-backed operation in which the foreign intelligence likely intervened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that you referenced the 1953 CIA coup, Operation Ajax. And in case people aren't familiar with it, it wasn't just, you know, a sort of, you know, so-called clean coup where Kermit Roosevelt and, you know, and a couple of generals walked in and deposed the democratically elected leader. It began with CIA organized street riots. And in fact, I was looking again at Stephen Kinzer. We had him on the show actually a while ago. Stephen Kinzer's book, All the Shah's Men. And I mean, this sounds, this sounds very familiar here. He talks about how Kermit Roosevelt, he is actually related to FDR and Teddy Roosevelt, and he was the top CIA man, point man for this operation. It says here, you know, his next task was to arrange disorders. For this, he called on his well-connected agents, Jalili and Kevani. First, he told them he wanted, quote, black crowds, unquote, that would rampage through the streets, shouting their allegiance to communism and Mossadegh. They were to break windows, beat innocent bystanders, shoot at mosques, and generally arouse the outrage of citizens. And later, you know, he has these rent-a-rioters screaming, you know, death to Mossadegh, long live the Shah, rioters attacking and burning government buildings, police stations, mosques, fire, you know, they had gunfire, they snuck guns in, and then, of course, that eventually got Mossadegh to try to crack down, which created everything worse. I mean, it sounds, I guess it's just hard to know how much of this is organic and not organic, but it certainly sounds like a pretty typical playbook.
It certainly does. And I mean, part of one reason that I say that there was likely foreign intervention is not because, you know, the Iranian media is saying it. It's because right now, as you know, the internet is shut, so we don't have access to international internet, but we can access are just local sites and not even all of them. So, I mean, mostly just following the Iranian news, and here the claim is that there was foreign sabotage and foreign intervention. But then a part of your audience will likely say that, well, we won't believe the Iranian government. Mm-hmm. But that's okay. You don't have to believe the Iranian government. What you can believe, and your source can be, as you were saying, Mark, is history. And if you look at historical precedents, there are numerous cases of the imperialists and the U.S., especially after the Second World War, organizing an existing opposition or creating a fake opposition in order to insert that opposition within an organic protest movement to bring about certain political objectives. And as you mentioned, during 1953, when the U.S. and the British, the CIA and MI6, partly through their embassies, assisted in the coup d'etat against Mohammad Mossadegh, who was who nationalized Iranian oil in 1951. Some of the tactics were very similar. So there were riots. This is one interesting thing that you probably have not heard in the Western media. But when I go around the city here and I talk to people who witnessed the protests, I mean, let's say taxi drivers or other workers who were on the streets at night, they were telling me that a lot of the leaders of the protests were very big men. Mm-hmm. The women were also very strong. This was similar to what happened in 1953 when there's this infamous person named Shaban Eddin Bogh, who means the brainless Shaban. And he was organized, or he was assisted by the CIA to overthrow Mossadegh. And he was a very big guy, very intimidating guy. And, you know, he was one of the ringleaders in the sense that organized the coup d'etat against Mossadegh. And similar thing happened this time. There were all these, I mean, possibly they were organic and they didn't have any connections to the CIA or the Mossad. But most Iranians I've been talking to, they're kind of doubtful that these were just organic protesters. And a lot of them seemed kind of trained for the battleground. A lot of them had machetes. And also there were weapons, so especially outside Tehran, on the border towns as well, in the province of Iran, for example, there are many armed groups that joined into the protests on January 8th and January 9th.
There's one thing that I wanted to ask, just because it's been a standby of most Western accounts of the disorder in Iraq, and that is that Iraq had this big demographic bulge in the early 21st century. And there are a lot of really angry young Iranians who are tremendously impatient with the current regime for all kinds of reasons. Do you find that to be true?
I would say regarding the politics of the country and the different demographics in terms of ideology, I mean, you find everything here. I mean, there's a long tradition of socialism and communism that goes back all the way to the early 20th century, if not earlier, when you had the culmination of that into the Tudeh party that was active during the 1940s and the 1950s. And so there's that, there's communism, but there's also the Islamic ideology, which is the foundation of the Islamic Republican Party that eventually became the dominant ruling force in the country after 1980. And then you also have liberalism. So even within the Islamic ideology, you have a lot of people who are very fond of free market ideas and liberal ideas, including new liberalism. So there's an advocacy for privatization, for the private sector becoming stronger. And in the Iranian case, it makes a bit more sense because the public sector here is so big that it kind of subsumes everything. So the kind of neoliberal advocates, they want a larger private sector, but then some of them aren't really aware of the adverse consequences of neoliberalism, the adverse consequences it could have for the social safety net that the government actually provides here to many people. And some examples of that are, I mean, not to go on a tangent here, but very briefly, so things like electricity, natural gas, gasoline for the car, they're all very cheap and subsidized here. The bread as well, bread is very cheap. And so there's that, and that actually, I think a lot of that comes from that strong legacy of socialism. So even though after the revolution, there was a crackdown on many communist and leftist groups in the country, what's interesting is that organized communism kind of went away, but then the ideas kind of remain. And there's this strong kind of socialist welfare programs that happen here. Some of them also go to the Islamic ideology, because even if you look at Hezbollah and Hamas, who operate based on the Islamic ideology, they also have provided a lot of social services. But going back to your question, not to deviate too much from your question, regarding the younger demographic, so you find both people who are very committed to the revolutionary ideology and to Islamic ideology among the young, whose either parents are from revolutionary families or they themselves, you know, are committed to it ideologically and philosophically. But you also find a lot of Iranians who are very pro-West. And because they're pro-West, they're also anti-China and anti-Russia. So you find both demographic. So within the younger generation, there's definitely both. I don't have any clear, you know, data or polling about it, but just from anecdotal experience, I've encountered both, and I've taught at the University of Tehran, where, you know, most of the students who are ages, you know, 18 to 25, and within University of Tehran students, I would say most of them lean more liberal in terms of their ideology, and perhaps more pro-West. But then the University of Tehran is kind of elite university, and you kind of find that in most elite universities in the global south, where, you know, the elites kind of gravitate towards liberalism and being, you know, pro-US, pro-West. But in other universities, you find more revolutionary ideology among the students.
How about nationalism among the young? And I don't know if this crosses over to calls for the clown prince, as Max Blumenthal calls him. But anyway, the so-called crown prince, Pahlavi, to come back. I mean, there were people calling for that. I don't know if every one of them were paid. My sense is, you know, the way these work is you pay a certain number of people and you then you tap into legitimate grievances and like real. You know, there is always going to be discontent, and certainly in a situation like Iran, there's going to be probably a lot more discontent than the normal place. So you use the, the provocateurs to sort of organize larger discontent. But how popular what is the base of support for Pahlavi and or a kind of like, which I've heard about from some other Iranians, a kind of, maybe it's marginal, maybe not, but a kind of neo-nationalism, far-right nationalism even. Is there any of that? And was that involved in this?
No, there is indeed. That's an interesting question. Yes, I mean, one reason that the protests got violent was because of the statement issued by the crown prince, or the so-called crown prince, Reza Pahlavi, who actually resides in Virginia. And I don't think he's ever had a real job. Maybe he has, but I mean, he's been living from the wealth of his father, the Shah, you know, who had money overseas after he fled Iran and left Iran in 1979. So it got violent after his statement, not necessarily because of his statement, but I think that played a part. But he does enjoy some popularity in the country, not because of himself so much, but because of his father and especially grandfather, because his grandfather, Reza Shah, who ruled Iran from 1925 to 1941, was a big modernizer in the style of Atatürk, who modernized modern Turkey, which used to be called Turkey, but now it's under Turkish wishes, I call it Turkey. So it's very similar to Atatürk, a big modernizer. And one reason he is liked by Iranians to this day is because he set the foundations for modern Iran, and he built a lot of the modern institutions, such as the modern state, the modern army, the modern bureaucracy. And I mean, if you want to take a more Halabian approach or a more post-colonial approach, people say that these modern things aren't so good. The modern state is not a good thing because, as I mentioned earlier, it does have that repressive state apparatus. It is violent, you know, it is repressive, all that. So for many, the modern state is not a good thing, but then for a lot of Iranians, because their country was suffering at the hands of the colonialists or lacking modernization, they see that as kind of a positive intervention into Iranian history, because he modernized the country and made it stronger, made a central state and started some industrialization programs. But because of the kind of affection some Iranians have for him, they also like his grandson. And also some nostalgia for the Shah, especially the families that were better off in the 1960s and 70s, the middle class, the professional middle class, for example, that was able to travel, and the Iranian currency was stronger then. Even though my assessment is that the Iranian purchasing power wasn't that great in the 1960s and 70s either, but still, because the economy appears to have been more stable in the 60s and 70s, there is this nostalgia for the Shah. And so, again, because of Reza Shah and the Shah, some people like his son, even though he hasn't really done much for the country at all. And so I actually attribute it not so much to political literacy or intelligence, rather it comes from the lack of political literacy. And because of the lack of political literacy and not really understanding geopolitics and not understanding history, a lot of people find him as a nice alternative to the current Islamic Republic. And so he does enjoy some popularity, especially among the older generation. But I think for people who are more politically literate, he's not treated very seriously. And even what's really funny and ironic is that both the Jerusalem Post, an Israeli newspaper, and Rudy Giuliani, our favorite politician, they both condemned him as being irrelevant to Iran's political future.
Wow.
Is that because Giuliani's on the payroll of the MEK, or... And I'm curious, since I mentioned the MEK, which is, for listeners who may not know, we've talked about him, but this is this very bizarre cult that grew out of a revolutionary group in the 70s and just became a very weird and, you know, and very violent cult. So is the MEK operating in Iran? Would they have any hand in any of this?
Yeah, so MEK is another opposition group that operates from the diaspora. And one reason that the Islamic Republic Party in the 1980s really cracked down on leftists and executed many goes to MEK, because MEK was probably the most organized armed group opposed to the Islamic Republic Party, and they were carrying out a lot of assassinations against the Islamic Republican Party members. So even the current leader, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who has injured hand. So if you look at one of his hands is it looks like it's almost amputated. And the reason for that is he was a target of an assassination attempt by the MEK in the 1980s. So he lost one of his hands. And so that's, you know, because I'm referencing my earlier response that there's some Republic Party executed and marginalized many of the leftists, and that was in response to the MEK's violent activities in the 1980s. But they operated from the diaspora, so initially they were in Iraq and supported by Saddam Hussein, but after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein in the 2000s and Iranian expanding influence in Iraq, they were expelled from Iraq, and now they're in Albania for whatever reason. I don't know why Albania decided to take them on, but they were also being trained by the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, I think in Nevada for a while. They were training them for armed activities against the Iranian government, but also a lot of the scientists, the nuclear scientists that were assassinated by Israel, they were done by MEK inside the country. So they had organized MEK members to assassinate the scientists, but they don't have any standing in the country, really. They're not a recognized political party. They're outside the country, and also they're not popular. And one thing that I often hear, I mean, Reza Pahlavi has some popularity, but then about the MEK, no matter who you talk to, they say that if the MEK takes over, I'll take a gun myself and fight them. So this is something that you often hear. So they're not very popular.
Yeah, as I recall, they sort of invaded Iran with an Iraqi armed force in the later stages of the war, and that kind of destroyed any support they might have had.
Yeah, they in 1988, I think, in the last year of the war, they invaded and they got crushed, as I recall too, and that pretty much spelled the end for them, at least as an invading force. What is the base of support for the government and Khamenei? And I mean, I don't know if you want to parse it a little bit, but the base for Khamenei himself, the supreme leader, versus the president, Pezeshkian, who is more of a reformist and has, I would imagine, a different, maybe more, I don't know what the support level is, but maybe you could talk about that because... you know, Khamenei's been there a long time. Are people generally okay with that? Or like which segments of the population are pro-government and which are maybe against?
The one thing is Iran doesn't have very systematic polling the way the U.S. does. But there are some polls. But again, I will speak more based on my historical knowledge and also anecdotally just, you know, experiencing and knowing Iran through my lived experience, but also, I mean, you could refer to the election data. So with the election data in the last election, that the turnout was a historic low because, you know, we had elections here where about 70-80% of the population participates, but because of the inflation, the last presidential election between Pezeshkian and Saeed Jalili, I think the turnout was a little less than 50%, so comparable to American presidential elections this time. Mm. And then Jalili, who is probably the most revolutionary candidate, he's all for not normalizing with the West, not negotiating, having a very robust domestic manufacturing industry, and also enforcing the mandatory veilings, also being kind of a religious conservative on the social and the moral issues. He had 13.5 million votes, which I think, I mean, the population, you know, so remember that conversation between Tucker Carlson and Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz did not know Iran's population, but the population is about 90 million, maybe 92 mm-hmm. million now. But even if you say we take 13.5 million, from 90 million, that's a pretty notable chunk of the population that voted for him. Mm. And he's even, I would say, more, in some ways, he's more even revolutionary than the leader, Ali Khamenei, is. So in that sense, you could say this whole republic system has a social base and is popular. And that's actually one of the reasons that it has persisted for 47 years now, because the Islamic Republic did not come to power through some coup d'etat or through some military. I mean, if you look at Middle Eastern history, it's filled with these stories, including Reza Shah, that ruled Iran from 1925 to 1941. He was a military officer that came to power through the coup d'etat that was actually encouraged by the British. And you have numerous other examples during the mandatory period. So when the British and the French administrated the mandate system between the First World War and the Second World War and created all these arbitrary borders in the Middle East, there were so many military generals that were coming to power, and there was a disconnect between the ruling elites and the larger population. But despite what the Western media claims, and you know, so you don't have to agree with Islam Republic, but what, as a historian, I have to be honest and say that they have a very large social and popular base, and the revolution, the government came out of the revolution, came out of a popular revolution. So if you get the American Revolution, because your audience is probably the U.S., I mean, the American system of government comes out of a secular white supremacist movement, but for some reason we don't call the American government an American regime, but then the Western polemicists call the Iranian government a regime. So there's that irony.
Regime is a bad word.
But because it comes out of the pot. It is indeed, it's polemical, and I would also say dehumanizing, because what happens with imperialism is that in the high colonial period, say the late 19th century all the way to the Second World War, you try to dehumanize people based on their culture and their language and their customs and social habits. But once that's no longer useful, because imperialism enters a new mode of operation after 1945, then you start demonizing politics and you start demonizing governments that are different from Western governments, whether it's the Cuban government or the Venezuelan government or the Iranian government or whatever. So that's why I don't use the term regime. I just call it the Iranian government to be both fair and historical and also not dehumanizing toward the Iranians. So because it comes out of the popular revolution, there is a large social base that has persisted to this day. And what's really interesting is I went, as a spectator, I went to the march that happened on January 12th against foreign intervention and in support of the Iranian government. And the crowds were massive. They were so massive that I was too scared to go near the crowds. I was just kind of watching it from the sidelines. I was also worried about the insecurity that the country has suffered because something could have happened during the march, and it could have been, say, a violent shooting by some of the protesters or the people who were likely organized by the Mossad. So I avoided the heart of the crowd, but just watching it from the side street, there were massive crowds that came out, and they were probably in the, a couple million that came out in Tehran. So that shows that there is this large popular base. And also the leader has his own popularity, partly because he was a revolutionary. So in the 1960s and 70s, he was a young organizer and a revolutionary, and he was exiled into the Balochistan province, which is one of the poorest provinces in the country. And he served the people of Balochistan there for some years before the revolution happened, and then eventually became president, and now he's the leader. And he's also very popular. And to the point that, I mean, he does have his hardcore supporters that during the protests, if there were protesters who were insulting the leader, they were using curse words against the leader, some of the refugees who are part of the security forces would, you know, get violent towards them. So there's that kind of liking for him. But then there's also another demographic that does not like him and see him as the cause of, because he has so much power and he's the cultural and military leader of the country. They see him as being the cause of the problems that Iran is currently facing.
Right. So how, getting back again to the protests, you know, one of the big questions, just the general journalist question, whatever, is how many people were killed?
It's unclear to me now. I mean, I saw reports by Western NGOs, all of which are basically imperialist actors. They're either funded by Western intelligence, or they're very much connected to the DC establishment. So there's one organization called, I think, the Human Rights Harana, Human Rights
Activists in Iran.
Agency, I think
with the National Endowment for Democracy backing them.
Exactly. So the NED backs them. So they're not an organic human rights organization connected to Iran, and most of the reports they have and claims they have, I'm very skeptical about, because they have these political objectives. And I think their numbers was very high. I think they were reporting 12,000. I'm not sure, but either them or some other Western organization was claiming 12,000. But today I saw Iranian media reports, and one of them was saying that there were a couple thousand dead, but it's not, you know, they're still collecting the data on it. So, I mean, most likely somewhere in between the two numbers, but I would say there are at least a couple thousand people who were killed. But this includes also the security forces, because an interesting difference between Iran and the U.S. is that in the U.S., you can't really, you know, you can even like put a finger on the cuff. I mean, we saw what happened with ICE killing the woman in Minnesota. I mean, I don't think she was even putting a finger on him. I think she just like misunderstood something, and then he shot her in public. But here, not the security forces that are the special security forces or the Basij or Revolutionary Guard, but rather the regular police are actually very non-intimidating. A lot of times the protesters actually gang up on them and beat them up. So there were also a lot of policemen who were killed during the protests and riots. And so it's not clear if there are a couple thousand killed. It's not clear how many were security forces and how many were regular protesters. We just have to wait and see what the numbers are. There's also... I think the Iranian government and the hospitals will also release some data, but we have to wait and see, and then just use our best judgment as to how many people were killed.
You know, talking to you, everything there sounds so much different than the picture we get from our media in the West. In the West, the picture is extremely unpopular, repressive police state regime, clinging to power, murdering young people who just want to be free from this, you know, murderous, tyrannical regime, as they love that word, regime, as you rightly pointed out. But the way you talk about it and describe it, it reminds me a lot of how the massive chasm between how things looked inside Russia in the years that I was living and reporting from there, and how it was reported from outside as this, like, you know, terrifying Putinist police state. And I mean, I think it's gotten pretty bad there legitimately in the last, since 2021. But definitely when I was out there, it was nothing at all like the picture of it. And the way you're describing Iran, like, you know, you're not scared of getting picked up. I mean, it's like you could go to places where violence was happening, but you could also easily avoid it. You're not like walking down the street terrified of every thought in your head of, you know, or speaking the wrong word out loud. So I guess I just wanted to say it sounds very different. It doesn't sound like this Orwellian dystopian tyranny from the way you're describing it, but more like that the government has a real genuine base of support, that, you know, the population is somewhat divided. But that it's not on the verge of toppling, which is the real narrative being pushed out here, which is, you know, they're trying to convince Trump, if he just bombs a few key places or kills a few key people, that the regime is on the verge of being toppled. And it really doesn't sound that way at all from talking to you.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, the whole dystopian totalitarian image of Iran, I mean, it's a favorite of actually Western and American consumption culture. So if you look at the films and the novels that they read, it's always about, you know, some very scary thing that's happening here. And I mean, what's actually really interesting to me is that there are many Iranians who have been to Western jails because of supposedly violating U.S. sanctions or for whatever other national security reason. And when they're released and they come back to Iran, there's no industry here to support them to write a book about, you know, what a scary place a French or a British jail was. But then when there is an American or a Western journalist who's in prison here, and then they're released and they go back, there's an entire industry for them to write books and, you know, hold conferences and talk about what a scary place Iran is. And in a way, it's monetized, and there's this financial social clout after you've been to prison too long. And I think it kind of facilitates that totalitarian dystopian image that the Western public wants to consume about places like Iran. And I would also add places like Russia and Venezuela, North Korea, or wherever else. And I mean, this doesn't mean that repression doesn't happen, because as I mentioned, Althusser's idea, I think, is very useful, because for him, it's a nonpartisan idea. The idea that if you have a modernist state, you have a repressive state apparatus that becomes operational during things like protests and even outside protests, you know, in order to stay in power, that repressive state apparatus has to function. And so Iran has that too, but then in my judgment, it is not, you know, any more Orwellian or dystopic or totalitarian than, you know, many other governments in the world. But what is true is that because Iran suffers from more insecurity compared, say, to the U.S. as an empire, the state might assert repression more frequently or more force in some cases, but in other cases, perhaps not. So I think it's just contextual, and we have to look at the context and evidence to say, you know, when it's actually kind of scary and when it's not. And one example of things that are scary is the internet, because they have shut down the internet now for 2 weeks. So you can go on the local websites and the local apps, but you cannot use the international internet. That's why, you know, we're doing the phone call instead of me talking to you on Zoom or some other app. And the thing is, there is a council for the internet that has representatives from different branches of the government, and they vote on the internet shutdown during national emergencies. And in this case, they voted yes, but it is scary that they have this ability to totally shut down the internet, because, you know, when there's not a national emergency, they can use the same powers to also shut down the internet. So there is that. But then again, I think everything has to be judged based on context and evidence.
There were so many reports coming out directly from Mossad's account, from former CIA chief Mike Pompeo's account, and other accounts, Israeli media, boasting that they had Mossad agents all over working in Iran and working with the protesters and inside the protesters. So what is that what people are talking about inside Iran as well? And, you know, also, I guess this relates to the question of how porous Iran is, because clearly Mossad agents have been able to work inside Iran, as we saw in the 12-day war and various assassinations.
That's right. So I'd say, I mean, there is a perspective here that the foreign threat is exaggerated, and in the diaspora too, you hear that too often, that, you know, the foreign threat is exaggerated. And I mean, if you follow the Western media or the Persian language media that are located in the West, they don't even make any references to the likelihood of Mossad and the CIA organizing some of the so-called protesters turned rioters. So there is that perspective here that that's exaggerated and that's not the case, and the vast majority were organic. But there's also this other perspective that there was a lot of foreign organization or support, that, and a lot of these rioters were inserted themselves into the protest, which also made it more difficult for the security forces to respond, because they weren't necessarily able to distinguish between some of the foreign backed groups and the protesters. So you're right that Iran does suffer from insecurity, in the sense that Mossad has been able to infiltrate and work through native agents here, including the MEK members that are here. They have carried out assassination against scientists and generals, and also against Ismail Haniyeh, who was one of the leaders of Hamas, and he was here. He was in Iran for the inauguration of President Pezeshkian, and he was assassinated in his hotel room, which also, I mean, goes against that totalitarian image of Iran, because in some ways, especially when compared to a place like Israel or even a place like U.S., more so Israel, I would say, security here is more haphazard, and a lot of times it's not as tight as people might think. And then, you know, things get through. And even when it comes to the internet, I mean, even though they have this totalitarian ability, in a sense, to shut down the internet, but then when it comes to the media that people consume, a lot of it are propagandist, pro-Western, anti-government media, such as so-called Iran International or BBC Persian, and people have wide access to those channels. And, you know, they consume it through their satellite dishes or through the internet because everyone, not everyone, but most will have VPN. So they get through the blockage system that the government has for these websites and these medias.
Yeah, I mean, just speaking of that, you know, there have been reports. I was looking at an old Newsweek article from 2007 during the Iraq surge under George W. Bush. And the article talked about a new CIA program that Bush signed off on. This is 2007, to open up Iran's internet to make sure that people had access to internet. It was a destabilization CIA program. And one of the key planks of it was to make sure that internet access was widened and opened up. And, you know, the internet was developed by the Department of Defense for a reason. You know, I mean, obviously it has many uses, but one of them is imperial management and command and control and spying and cracking open, hostile states and so on and so forth. Last question. So just again today in the Wall Street Journal and Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal, there's a big article, front page article that Trump has asked, is seeking a, quote, decisive blow against Iran, against the IRI. And, you know, they are moving all kinds of military assets, as far as we've been able to see, carrier groups and air assets closer to Iran. You just had the 12-day war. Are people nervous about this? Like, what would the effect, do you think, of American bombing be? Is there a decisive blow that can be made? Like, if they kill the supreme leader, would that shake the government? Would that crack it?
Interesting question. Regarding the first part of the question, the mood of the people, because as you're saying, there is this buildup. And even if there was not a buildup that we have been witnessing in the past couple of weeks, there is always the possibility of war after the 12-day war, where U.S. and Israel attacked Iran unprovoked, and also Israel assassinated a number of scientists and Iranian generals. But despite Iranians experiencing 12-day of bombing that was unprecedented in their recent history, so the last war they had and the last major insecurity they had was their war with Saddam Hussein with Iraq from 1980 to 1988, which, by the way, the U.S. supported Saddam Hussein in that war against Iran. And that was the last major insecurity they suffered, and, you know, hearing jets and bombing and so on. And so this was, you know, for especially for people who were born after 1988, such as myself, we have not had experienced such a thing in a very long time. So it was a shock in a way. But at the same time, I'm very amazed by the calm here and by the courage of Iranians. So if you talk to people, the war is not even really on their mind. They're more worried about inflation and whether they're going to be able to afford to buy a home or buy a car. They're not really thinking about Israel or the U.S. very much. And you have to actually, like, bring it up for them to talk about it. And there's also this trust in the defensive capability of the country, especially because despite the sanctions, Iran has been developing a very strong a missile program, and that was a deterrent against Israel in the 12-day war. Otherwise, I think Israel would have continued the war until it would turn Iran into another Syria or Lebanon that it could bomb at will. And that is the objective now. So both the U.S. and Israel, I don't even think they want regime change as such. Mm-hmm. So they're not really interested in bringing someone like Reza Pahlavi and creating this strong U.S.-Israel-friendly government. So they don't want to create. So this is an interesting thing here, is that a lot of pro-West people here, they have this kind of deluded perspective that if the U.S. and Israel come and bomb the country and do a regime change, Iran will become another Japan. But from my historical and geopolitical knowledge, that will not be the case. And what they want is not even regime change and a U.S.-friendly government. that's an industrial powerhouse in the region and pro-Israel, they want to turn Iran into a fractured, failed state. And I mentioned the Wall Street Journal. There was actually an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago where it said that a fractured Iran might not be so bad. So there is this balkanization program or plan by the U.S. and Israel, and they want to turn Iran into a failed state. But people are not scared here, and they kind of have trust in the defensive capability for the Iranian missile program to deter U.S.-Israeli attack, and also the size of Iran and the kind of, you know, the allies it has in the region and all those things will come to Iran's aid. So for that reason, people are not really talking about it very much, but when it does come up, there is this trust in Iran's capability. But also there is some trauma from the war. So I visited my friend's a neighborhood. It's called Pashtaran, which is a relatively wealthy neighborhood located in the north of Tehran. And I saw an entire building. And if it was a visual program, I would send you the picture. There was an entire residential building that was destroyed by Israel. You could still see the structure in place, but then, you know, everything was gone. There was no furniture. It was just dust and destruction. And there was another building next to it that was totally demolished. And I think that was hit on the last day of the war when a ceasefire was announced. And I think there was a government official lived there. But then in order to kill him, they destroyed a whole building and damage another one. And I saw that. And so people who live in that neighborhood, you know, I mean, they were frightened by something like that. So there is also that. And there is a real possibility of another unprovoked escalation where U.S. and Israel attack Iran again.
Right. But it doesn't seem to me from talking to you again that there is even the possibility of some kind of, you know, decisive blow, short of, I mean, going full scale, you know.
Well, the only kind of decisive blow I can see is that if that aircraft carrier moves into range of those really formidable, super fast, direction changing Iranian missiles, there's going to be one less aircraft carrier in the fleet.
Yeah.
That could be a deterrent in a sense. But then, I mean, there's no question that U.S. is more powerful militarily, but I think the question is how costly the war with Iran would be. And my assessment is that it would be costlier than Iraq, Afghanistan, Venezuela, and everything else in recent history combined.
Yeah, I think we've been saying that on the show as well. And I think if there are any functioning brains left in Washington, you know, that can stand up to Trump. they understand that as well. But in any event, you know, let's just hope it doesn't happen. With Trump, anything is possible. But I really want to thank you so much, Navid, for taking the time to talk to us. And I know our listeners, our subscribers will be very grateful as well to have heard you. And we hope to have you on Radio War Nerd again, too.
Thanks, Navid.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we will end the episode here. Thank you to our guest, Navid Zarinal, in Tehran. And thank you, John Brennan. Thank you to all our subscribers for making all this possible. Bye-bye.
Bye.